We're going to discuss the disclosure initiative, and I give the floor to Catherine.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everyone. So as Hans said, we're here to talk about the disclosure initiative this afternoon. We have one paper for you, which is a follow-up to the board's July decision to develop guidance for entities about which accounting policies to disclose. However, before we get to that paper, we wanted to give you a brief oral update on the targeted standards level review of disclosures project. The reason we've decided to do this is because whilst that project right now is not at a stage where we're ready to bring decision-making papers to the board, there is nevertheless a lot of work going on in the background. So we thought it would be useful for board members and for the good number of stakeholders who are expressing interest and support for the direction this project is taking to receive an update of exactly what is going on at the moment and where we're at. So to provide that oral update, over to Aisha.
Thank you. So at its September 2018 meeting, the board confirmed that it is happy with the draft guidance to use in developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements in future. So since then, the staff has been working on two primary activities towards applying that draft guidance for the board on the selected test standards. And those test standards are IAS 19 on employee benefits and IFRS 13 on fair value measurement. The two primary activities that the staff has been working on are planning stakeholder outreach and working with our taxonomy colleagues. I'll talk about stakeholder outreach first. And we view this as being absolutely critical in terms of thoroughly understanding users' views enough to develop effective disclosure proposals and objectives, as well as to understand the benefits and costs of any of those disclosure proposals for preparers and other stakeholders. Our approach so far has been to prioritize investor feedback in the first instance, as understanding users' ideal information set and the reasons for them are important foundation before subsequent discussion with preparers and other stakeholder types. So since the September board meeting, we have been working with our colleagues on the investor engagement team on our user outreach program. And for each of IAS 19 and IFRS 13, we've done a big piece of research to identify analysts who look at a good number of companies with significant disclosures in these areas. And within that research, we have considered geographical and industry coverage of the analysts that we're reaching out to. For both standards, we have included analysts who cover companies based in Europe, Asia, Latin America, Canada, and Africa. In terms of industry coverage, we think it is most important for IFRS 13, particularly to make sure that our research is not solely focused on financial institutions. In this regard, we have made sure to include other industries that have some substantial fair value measurement disclosures, for example, insurance, utilities, and conglomerate industries. This research that I've talked about is largely focused on sell-side analysts, and that's because we'll be seeking input from buy-side analysts through the contacts from the board's investment in financial reporting program. So with the help of our investor engagement team, we're now arranging outreach meetings with a geographically diverse mix of buy-side and sell-side investment professionals over the next couple of months. In addition, at the upcoming CMAC meeting on the 1st of November, we will highlight our outreach program to the members and invite any of the members who would like to participate to do so. Given the level of detailed feedback that we are looking for at this stage, we think it is more helpful to have individual meetings rather than a discussion with the group as a whole. After all of our outreach meetings have taken place, we then plan to bring a user feedback summary to the board. The second piece of activity that we've been working on is liaising with our taxonomy team. In particular, we're identifying any lessons that we might learn from their understanding of the common challenges or inconsistencies resulting from the application of IAS 19 and IFRS 13. We're approaching these two standards differently, which we think is helpful in testing the effectiveness of the taxonomy team involvement in different projects in the future. Firstly, on IFRS 13, the IFRS taxonomy team has recently undertaken a full common practice review on the disclosure requirements in the standard and an exposure draft summarizing their proposed changes to the IFRS taxonomy is currently out for comment until the middle of November. So we've used the findings from their review to identify issues to consider as we work through our outreach discussions. And this essentially relates to two things. Firstly, items for which common practice indicates that companies are interpreting IFRS 13 disclosure requirements in different ways. This suggests to us that the disclosure requirements in some parts of IFRS 13 might be unclear. And secondly, items for which common practice indicates that companies are disclosing information that is not explicitly required by the standard. This suggests that there might be some useful information that's currently not required by IFRS 13. So having performed this review, we're in the process of discussing our takeaways with our taxonomy representative to seek their advice and input. Then, where relevant, we will raise the issues identified within our outreach discussions. In contrast, the involvement of the IFRS taxonomy team on IAS 19 at this stage is different, and that's because they're yet to complete a full common practice review on the standard. Instead, the team is using their knowledge and experience with IAS 19 to identify any existing issues for our information. This is happening at the moment, and similar to IFRS 13, we plan to factor any issues identified into our outreach discussions. We understand that the IFRS taxonomy team is now planning to undertake a full common practice review on IAS 19, similar to IFRS 13. However, we think it is important to continue with our outreach program on IAS 19 in absence of the full common practice input, and we'll consider the information from the IFRS taxonomy team as it becomes available. And we think that this approach will be helpful in understanding the feasibility of the IFRS taxonomy input for an early stage project in the absence of them having taken a full common practice review on the standard in question. So with that overview, rather long one, does the board have any questions, comments, or suggestions on the status of the targeted standards level review of disclosure projects?
That's not the case.
Yes. Yeah. On to 11A then, so I'll just get straight into it. So the board discussed the next steps on this topic in its July 2018 meeting, and in light of all of the feedback received, the board tentatively decided to firstly develop additional guidance and examples for the materiality practice statement, and also to consider at a future meeting whether it would like to make any amendments to the requirements of the IFRS standards, for example, IAS 1. So today we will only be focusing on the development of additional guidance and examples for the practice statement. I will group the questions together just because some of them are very closely related, so the discussion will flow a lot easier if we do it that way. So paragraphs 5 to 11 summarize feedback on accounting policy disclosures. In particular, users have said that accounting policy disclosures are only really useful when they relate to material transactions, other events, or conditions, and provide insight into how an entity has exercised judgment in selecting and applying its accounting policies. So in light of that feedback, paragraphs 17 and 18 summarize the proposed approach to developing the guidance and examples to help preparers identify when an accounting policy itself is material to the financial statements. So question one for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board should clarify that not all accounting policies relating to material transactions, other events or conditions are material to the financial statements? I will pause here for discussion.
And Joe?
Thank you, Hans. I agree with staff's proposal. I think to avoid the entity just to simply repeat the requirements of standards and disclose all the accounting principles, whatever they are material or not. So I think the clarification is very important. But I need a further clarification with the question. Yeah, we ask that all accounting policies relating to material transactions, other events or conditions, because normally accounting policy apply to transactions, events, in which circumstances apply to conditions. And I checked the word, maybe it come from the practice statement, paragraph 46, That is the qualitative factors we should consider, whether those information material or not. So we just exactly follow those terms to our question. But I think different disclosure content may be different for with regard to accounting policy. Accounting policies may be only related to the transactions and event. For some accounting, you know, judgment, estimation, maybe we should consider conditions, something like that. So, yeah, this is in which circumstance we need accounting policy related to the conditions.
Yeah, I think that's a fair challenge, and your description of why we use that wording is entirely correct. We did it to be consistent with every other place, particularly the materiality practice statement. We thought it would be more unhelpful to use different language than to try and make it more specific. So I'm afraid off the top of my head, I don't have an example for you, but our goal was to use language that already exists today to avoid any questions about are we talking about different things here.
Doug? Thank you. Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation. And especially, I really like the sentence you used in paragraph 14b. You said, to achieve this, we think the board needs to provide entities and other stakeholders with the tools they need to have confidence in judging policies to be immaterial when appropriate. I think that is the whole point. Entity need a confidence when they make a decision that it is not material. So in this sense, diagram, the flowchart you showed, Appendix C, would be useful. But I'm a bit confused with this flowchart. Just help me to understand. So first, you decide based on the materiality of transaction itself, the accounting policy relating to material transaction, accounting policy relating to not material transaction. And if it is relating to not material transaction, maybe a disclosure of accounting policy may not be required. That is the first step. But what if the measurement of transaction became immaterial because of the change of the accounting policy? If such case happens, the first year, maybe you will disclose what kind of accounting policy change you have made. But from next year, then the transactions, at least measurement number, became immaterial. So in that case, what should we do? Do they have to talk about accounting policy still? Or if the size of the account balance on the balance sheet became immaterial, they can neglect their accounting policy disclosure. Okay, if we follow this flowchart.
Yes, no, I understand. So our idea behind this diagram was for people to identify that accounting policies, in particular identifying whether information is immaterial or material, is to refer to, I think it's paragraphs 46 to 55 in the practice statement, which gives quite a lot of detail and guidance over qualitative and quantitative factors of information. So I guess our main focus would be to refer people to that when they are applying the four-step materiality process in identifying whether something, it may not be material quantitatively, but it may be material qualitatively, in which case, if you do identify that, then it might be material and therefore might be considered for disclosure in the financial statements.
Right. So in this case, the first line to judge whether the transaction is material or not is really important. And in order to make a decision for that first line, then you have to consider qualitative things as well, based on the material practice statement, paragraph 42. 46 to 50 something. Okay, good. Thank you.
Gary.
Thank you. I actually completely agree with the staff's recommendations, but we can do it on Appendix C, but it could come up someplace else. Just to clarify, when you look at The box to the left on Appendix C, accounting policy related to immaterial transactions. I read all these guidance we give. If I didn't want to do it, how do the words help me not do it? I would say a company is composed of thousands of immaterial revenue transactions. So a transaction singularly, but in the aggregation, they're material. But if I read this and I didn't want to do it, related to immaterial transactions, there's very few material revenue transactions individually. It's the collective aggregation of it. And I just think we need, if not in the box or maybe the footnote, we need to clarify that it could be a group of similar transactions, individual material and aggregate material, someplace clarify it. Otherwise, fully on board.
Mary?
Also generally supportive of the staff recommendation, but have a couple of messaging suggestions, and then one thought about how it fits in with the materiality practice statement generally. The messaging comment on this in particular is, I think it could matter whether we express it as a positive that not all accounting policies are material versus saying, and my preference would be in this case to state it the other way around, which is accounting policy is not automatically material, even if the transaction or events is/are, get the verb right, because it's saying, I think if we put a positive out there that not all policies are material, you're almost saying now assess each one, go through each one, as opposed to we're just trying to confirm, provide confidence and talk, words, that it's not automatic and hardwired that if the balance is material, that the accounting policy is material, mm-hmm. the balance of the amount. The second thing, again, this is messaging, is I think it's really important that we keep emphasizing that this is accounting policy, disclosures of accounting policies rather than disclosures about the item, because sometimes there are times when, and we have an example of this in the materiality practice statement, when disclosure that you have only an immaterial amount of something is material information. So I think we have to just keep, I have to stay focused to remind myself this is accounting policies we're talking about, and that you might make a different decision for the accounting policies versus the other disclosures relating to that item. And while you have that in the examples further on, I think we have to keep messaging about that. Or otherwise says, well, once I decide it's, the accounting policy is not material, I'm done considering disclosures for that item, and that's not what we're saying. And then the question that I'd like to ask you to think about, and this deals with the issue of material when you consider which period or periods, because, and I think it is something that we discussed in the materiality practice statement, but there are different views around the world whether the comparative information, the comparative period or periods that are presented are being presented, and therefore you have to consider materiality of information related to the comparative period or periods, or whether you make the determination based solely on the current period, and then the comparatives are in effect an additional disclosure that gives context. There are two different views. I have a feeling that we addressed this in the materiality practice statement already, but I think we just want to look at it for accounting policies again and make sure there's no tweak. I don't have a desired outcome, but I think it's tricky in terms of how we express it when you're looking at, as you say, transactions or classes of transactions, to Gary's point, or events. Are you looking only at the most recent period presented, or are you also looking at prior periods and thinking about how we address that? So just that's a takeaway, not for today.
And on one hand side, I agree to that. But on the other hand, I thought to myself, if we now also starting to judging what is material and immaterial accounting policies, and is it only quantitative or qualitative thing? Because if you have, for example, transactions which sends the total company comes from a loss into a gain situation or vice versa, or the trend is moving, even if the transaction by itself is immaterial, it is very difficult to judge that then. Okay, do you have to disclose it? or don't have to disclose that. So I thought myself, is it really helpful what we are doing here? Because when it is a kind of, with all this judgment management has to do now with disclosure and accounting policies, when in the past they had maybe, I don't know, it was obvious 15 policies every year done in the financial statements and maybe updated a little bit, that was an easy job. Now they have to think every end of the year or even quarter, okay, what kind of policies are material, not material. In addition, we have decided, okay, that if material, I would say now, accounting policies are obscured by immaterial accounting policies, then it is a material error. That is based on our definition now of materiality. So this becomes more difficult for people to doing. And is it really helpful? And at least I think for preparers, I think it is maybe not helpful. Maybe for users, it is end of the day helpful. But I thought also, because when I worked in practice, it is also my financial statements have to be, I think, signed off by, in Germany, by the supervisory board. Supervisory board contains not only professional accountants, it contains also people from the employer side, which has to work on the supervisory board. For them, it is helpful to understand, even if, for example, this straightforward revenue recognition standard, to say, okay, what is maybe in half a page the core principles how a company is doing revenue recognition, or for a bank how the company is calculating accrued interest, or whatever, because maybe a straightforward is in the standard, but I thought at least for the main part of the business of this kind of companies, for many users, which may be not primary users, as Onyx got now, that is helpful. That is helpful. And therefore, I think, do we really doing here the right things? Because it makes it more difficult, and at least for some users, they're losing some information, which are not people who looking at that books and study that books and standing all the kind of revenue. They maybe are helpful if it is in one page described, even if it's straightforward, what are the main revenue recognition principles the company applies, or impairment rules, whatever. Therefore, I think on one hand side, and then maybe Mary has said, okay, make it more positive, saying that maybe not all which are material relating to material transactions have to be disclosed. But I think it is, with all this process here, I think it would make life more difficult than before.
Nick?
I hear what Martin says. I think it's a question about what we want to achieve. I don't think even the primary users are going through the books to understand the standards. They rely on intermediaries, or they're relying on the internet to understand the standards. There's very few will be going through the books. I think there's some behavioural issues here, and the trouble is when we just have repetitions or summaries of the actual standards in the accounting policies, is that very quickly people stop reading them altogether and just move on. Because actually, I've been told I know this, and I think we then lose the critical information when it really matters. And there are many occasions when it does really matter. So I think, whilst I'm sympathetic, I support the proposal given what, you know, the problem we have out there.
Can I just add as well? In terms of a scenario in which we'd be troubling the definition of material, we'd be talking about a circumstance in which there was so much unnecessary accounting policy disclosure that it meant the useful stuff might as well not be there. And if it were to that extent, I would hope, and certainly our goal as we've been working through financial statements and thinking about our approach to the guidance, has been thinking that eliminating those pages and pages of reproducing standards would have benefit for companies as well as users, because, you know, we've looked at financial statements that quite literally have several pages of repetition of the standards. That's just one example. So what we're saying with this question is clarify that just because an item is material, you don't always have to give an accounting policy. Is the goal is to be helpful rather than to cause additional time or cost.
That is why I said on one hand side I'm agreed, but I'm concerned that there's a lot of judgment involved, and then especially if we have this material obscuring thing, so it makes it more difficult to come up with what is now an important or significant accounting policy.
Okay. Can we support the staff recommendation?
One.
13. Paragraphs 19 to 25 summarise the proposed content of the guidance for entities to use when applying the four-step materiality process to accounting policy disclosures. An example of what that guidance may look like has been included in paragraph 22, and it has been adapted from the content of the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper, where respondents identified this content as being useful. Paragraphs 26 to 32 summarise the proposed content of the examples demonstrating the application of the four-step materiality process to accounting policy disclosures. These examples have been developed to address key concerns stakeholders have raised about boilerplate or generic information being disclosed in accounting policies, and accounting policies which simply duplicate recognition and measurement requirements of the IFRS standards. We've included four examples to facilitate board discussion. However, we anticipate that, consistent with other topics in the materiality practice statement, only two or three examples will be developed as part of an exposure draft. Question two for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation to develop guidance to help entities apply effective judgment about whether accounting policies that relate to material transactions, other events or conditions are in fact material? And question three for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation to develop two or three examples to demonstrate the practical application of the guidance and base those examples on paragraphs 46 to 55 of the materiality practice statement? And I will hand over to the board now. Thank you.
Sue? I don't know whether I'm raising this at the right point or not, so I'm not being intentionally disruptive if it's not the right point. But I agree with the general approach that you're proposing in here and using the concept of materiality and the idea of using the materiality practice statement and using examples, so I agree with all of that. I think that my only comments in relation to the examples, I think they're just wording suggestions. I hope they're just wording suggestions, but I want to just check. And then I just did have one question about how difficult this might be to do in practice. It sort of builds a little bit on some of the points that Martin raised. So if I look at the examples, and I know these are only drafts, I'm not intending to be unduly picky, but just to make the point. In the examples, we've got some observations, like in 1A, we say that consequently the entity concluded that the policy is likely to be useful and is therefore material. Now, that to me is not a pure application of materiality in the way that we usually use those words, because materiality to me isn't just that it's useful, but rather that it's sort of at a higher level, it's so useful that if you didn't understand it or if it was misstated or whatever, it might influence the decision you would make. So I guess my first point is, I presume that's what we mean, in which case I think it would be helpful in the examples to be clear that it's the same test, particularly if it's going in the materiality practice statement. Because I think a lot of stuff, well, some stuff could be useful that might not be material, looked at in the whole particularly. And I guess my second, so good, you're nodding, so hopefully that is just a wording difference and not a difference in intent. Then my other question was just a sort of an observation, and it's not a reason for me not to proceed and ask people if they agree and to go ahead with the proposal. But I am a bit, if you asked me and shone lights in my eyes to tell you which accounting policies are such a big deal that understanding them properly could make me make a different decision, I think I might find that quite a bit harder than judging in a discussion with you whether, you know, just information about what the amount of property, plant and equipment is or whatever is material. Because it's, to me, it's a more nuanced question. So if I use the example of 1B, where we talk about revenue recognition and the fact that there's some sales that are sort of in-store and some are online, If I was, say, Amazon and they had some stores, there wouldn't be much difference between an in-store sale and an online sale because their deliveries are so quick. I think, you know, there'd be hardly any difference in revenue recognition. If, for example, I was a construction company and in some jurisdictions I might conclude my revenue is going to be recognised at a point in time versus overtime, I can see why understanding that policy in that case could be really material. But I think it's very... I think there could be quite a few cases where something's an important item in the financial statements, but whether you get to the level of understanding the policy is such a big deal that it could actually make me make a different investment decision. I'm not quite sure how to judge that. So I'm not sure it's the wrong question to ask people. I'm just not sure how easy an assessment it's going to be for people to get their heads around. Because to Mary's point, I have to keep reminding myself, we're not talking about the thing that we're recognising here. We're talking about, is the policy about the thing so important that it's material? And that's quite a different thing to ask me about.
So is your concern, sorry, just to be clear, that the examples that we've got don't quite help enough, or is it that trying to do this at all is concerning?
It's both. I think we need to be careful to choose examples which really illustrate this materiality point. So I wonder whether a less subtle example than online versus in sale and something more like point in time versus overtime for a construction company might be a better illustration of how it could be quite profoundly different in terms of timing. So it would be really important in that case to understand, you know, the countries or the contracts would fall in one camp or the other, because it could really affect the timing of income recognition, revenue recognition. So firstly, I think we have to be careful with our explanations, but also I think we're going to have to be very careful with the articulation to make it clear that it's the policy that we're talking about. And then I think we're just going to have to be very thorough in our outreach to make sure people understood what question they were being asked and to get really good feedback on whether they feel they can make that judgment. So it's not that it's a bad idea. I just think we have to be very clear with what we're asking.
Mary?
Couple of comments. One is, in your material drawn from the materiality practice statement, so page 8-9, paragraph 22, one is they were chosen from alternatives. I think we should be bringing out that there are two types of alternatives that we have in the standard. One is kind of unconstrained free choice. You have an accounting policy election. A second is when you are required to choose to make a choice based on the facts and circumstances in which policy provides the most useful information. And right now, little two is drafted really only about the free choice ones. So I think we have to bring in, because I think I'd want to know if there are two ways of accounting for something, but you know, if you think about the nature versus function analysis, and we're changing from free choice to you must choose, I can't remember the exact words of what the test is, but I think provides the most useful information. Maybe not for that one, because I'll know what you chose, but I want to know what factors you considered in developing that accounting policy. So I think we have to bring out both of those. And then the other thing is on page 14, the end of example 2A. This is kind of the thing I was talking about before about accounting policies versus other disclosures about the item. I think the comment that you're making in B is that material information about how the entity is applied 36 has been included because those are specific disclosure requirements. And I think that's the right observation to make, but I think we have to do the document equivalent of big red flashing lights around that to point out that, you know, deciding that the accounting policy for 36 may not be material and therefore would be excluded does not relieve you from the need to consider specific disclosure requirements in 36 relating to how you apply the requirements, you know, in this fact pattern. And that's a really important distinction, because we don't want the decision about materiality of, the requirements of 36 to wash out how I applied it, which could be quite important information.
Tom?
Just a couple of comments. One, just this is kind of a wordsmithy, but I just want to make sure. scenario one, paragraph 30, it says preparers believe will be useful. Believe will is a fairly high hurdle or a relatively easy hurdle to avoid. I just think. I'm not positive. I don't know, you just might want to watch the wording when we finally get there. And then the other comment I had was, I thought the examples, first of all, I like the examples. I think they're really useful. So paragraph 22C picks up the first four items from the discussion paper and then adds one. And you talk about doing two or three examples. I think maybe consider whether each of those five, like one of your examples, I tried to count how many show up. But it would be good, I think, having created this paragraph, which I think is good, when the examples is to draw some linking, and maybe even to think about actually an example where each of the five might be the predominant illustration, because an example should focus people. And if you put three in, then it's not as clear.
Okay, so just to say that the reason we landed on two or three is to be consistent with the rest of the practice statement and not give undue weight to one topic effectively, because it would be quite overriding. What we could certainly consider in developing exactly the examples to draft might be trying to get more than one into one example, if you see what I mean. So we can try and work out how to get that in.
Chen Chao.
Thank you, guys. I agree with the staff's proposal and comments. First, with regard to Mary's comments on accounting policy or free accounting policy choice or something like that, I think it's relevant to paragraph 22C and the second point. The paper gives an example about an option to measure investment property at either cost or fair value. So people will care whether it's free choice or not. My point is because paragraph 22 is very important guidance, so I think that maybe it's not necessary to give example. You simply mention that they choose from alternative accounting policy allowed by the IFRS standard enough, I think, yeah. And secondly, with regard to the paragraph 22C, that is five sentence, you mentioned that the accounting policy related to an area for which an entity has applied the requirements of an IFRS standard in a way that reflects its own unique circumstances. And paragraph 22D also mentioned accounting policy that describes how an entity applied those entity-specific accounting policy. Also mentioned this kind of policy relevant to those companies' own circumstances. So I think there's some overlap between those two sentences. Yeah, what's the difference between them? Whether we are talking about the same thing, same accounting policy, or different? Yeah.
To answer your question, when we were drafting the guidance, in particular point 22C5, we were thinking about instances where we have disclosure requirements, for example, property, plant, and equipment, where we don't dictate what the depreciation charge is. However, an entity takes the disclosure, I guess, or not the disclosure requirements, but the recognition and measurement requirements, and applies it in such a unique way. So, for example, an industry might depreciate a particular asset at a faster rate than a different industry. And in that case, you would want to see that disclosure because it's very much entity specific and it's reflective of how an entity has taken an accounting standard and applied it in their own terms. Point D is supposed to be more reflective of presentation. It's supposed to be a reminder to preparers that entity-specific information is overall more useful to users, and that might not have been phrased very well in the way that it's been written, but it's definitely something that we'll work on to make sure that those two points are definitely clarified very differently.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, that paragraph 22.3.5 also it's kind of entity-specific accounting policy. So I think if they're similar or same, it's better to illustrate those requirements at the same paragraph or same sentence or same paragraph. Otherwise, people will be confused because we have provided guidance. But if the guidance is not clear, people will still demand more guidance. What's the meaning of those sentences? Yeah.
Doc?
Thank you. I just would like to echo what Sue said. I'm a bit confused with example 1B. Example 1B looks good example. However, like Sue said, if it is useful for users, is it really worth explaining accounting policy? Say, for example, what if you are a conglomerate? Looking back my previous life, my company has a variety of businesses, including mining and supermarket and licensing. They are all quite different, revenue recognition accounting policies. So if you just simply say it's entity specific and could be useful for users, then it might be better to explain every single revenue recognition accounting policy. However, I don't think that is what you wanted to say. So just I would like to know what is the heart of this 1B example which you wanted to articulate?
In particular, we were trying to, communicate that at times only components of an accounting policy are in fact useful, and you don't need to put absolutely everything in your accounting policy with regards to recognition and requirement.
Yeah, but
everything we were trying to demonstrate that only in this particular circumstance, the preparer had determined that the users would only be interested in understanding the timing of revenue recognition, and therefore that was the only part of the accounting policy that they disclosed.
Yeah, but for example, the mining business recognition of revenue is quite difficult. For example, license business, it's difficult. So if you have a variety of business like that, so every single issue could be very useful for users and it's entity specific. So question is, to what extent we have to disclose? That is the point. But 1B doesn't really tell what is the key issue you have to select. So I think it's a good example. However, you have to add some more literature to explain why you thought it's quite critical for users to understand. Maybe including a quantitative issue or possibility of fluctuation or a possibility of divergence. So something like that should be added.
Could I just add to that? I think Chinchero and Tak, I think you've raised points that are actually very related, and it might be helpful if we clarify what I think we'll take away in terms of improving things for the next paper we bring. To reiterate Siobhan's earlier point, the difference between 22C5 and 22D is that we think that there's two issues here. One is, do you need to disclose an accounting policy in the first place, and the existence of entity-specific implication might be a trigger to make you consider doing that. But then having decided for whatever reason that you need to disclose an accounting policy, you then get to, well, you don't have to disclose chapter and verse, every single thing that, that you're doing with that item, just disclose the stuff that is genuinely useful or material to users, and that's the point that Dee is making. So that's the distinction between the two. And then example 1B, I think certainly from the comments from Sue, the comments from yourselves, this is certainly one we will look at and try and come up with a better way to make the points that we are making. But ultimately, they are to bring out those two things, i.e. if there is an entity-specific application, which, for example, might be that an accounting policy has sort of two different applications are being applied because there are two different types of revenue. A user might be interested in that, so that might be a trigger to disclose. Mm. And then in deciding what to disclose, if you conclude that is material, the very fact that there is entity-specific application suggests that it is the entity-specific application that is material and not everything else that might just repeat the standard. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So I think that makes sense, yeah.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. I agree with this new improvement from the three categorization. However, I'm wondering whether really we have improved our the previous model and to eliminate the kind of critics on these three categories. The critics on these three categories, they say they are confusing and overly prescriptive. That's their main criticism on three categories that's summarized in your paragraph 6. However, if we see the three categorization of this model and also with a new model in a summary of their appendix C, I don't see any big difference between these two. Because if you see appendix C, the first hurdle is you just eliminate some accounting policies that are not related to material transactions. That's a kind of a part of a category C in the three categorization model. The second step, among those accounting policies that are related to material transactions, some are material, some are not. That's related to categorization or category A and B in the previous model. So logically, conceptually, every hurdle suggested in these three categories model, we are doing the same thing here in Appendix C. But only maybe some major improvement is we don't need to separate the B category B and C. But we are still doing some same procedure, even though we do not explicitly say this is category B or C, but still we are doing some kind of procedure based on the concept. So I think this is a quite improvement, but I have no idea how to improve more to avoid that kind of criticism. It's confusing, overly prescriptive. So because of everything is quite similar to the previous model.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I think the difference is in the discussion paper we were considering if we would make any such guidance with regards to categorization, actually putting it into IAS 1. From this approach, we're not considering that at the moment. And whether or not we decide to in the future is another matter altogether. But with regards to something being too prescriptive, we were hoping, or the people liked the content, but they didn't like having the categories. So what we've really tried to achieve is remove reference to the categories and instead combine all of the information from the three categories that we got good feedback on. So that it was more a decision process rather than categorizing your accounting policies. And then I guess the placement in the materiality practice statement removes the concern that it's too prescriptive because we're not telling people that they have to disclose something or they don't have to disclose something. We're just giving them a tool that they can use when they're preparing their financial statements, and whether or not they decide to use it is up to them.
Yeah, that's a very good explanation. If you believe that explanation, you'd better put that explanation in the paper. We have some kind of criticism on the previous model. We improved this model. So you can resolve those issues, then it's okay. But yeah, that's the one.
Martin?
And again, and I understand your examples, because when in all the examples you want to tell maybe the users, okay, there is something specific, or you have to make a choice. But what I don't like is you mixing this up with the concept of materiality. And even if, for example, it's example 1B, if you have different revenue realization points with online and retail store sales, it isn't useful information, but is it material? I would say, as a preparer, would an investor buy a certain investment in a retailer because, okay, they knows, okay, that for online the revenue recognition is 2 days later than in the store? I would judge no. That would not influence his investment decision, so it's immaterial information. But I still think that is maybe useful information, and that is what I thought, because the SEC has used the significant accounting policies, but not used the term material, because I think it is something what, and I wanted to say really, man, I like what you propose, but I don't like mixing it up with materiality. I think it is okay. We should give guidance, okay, if it is specific, if it is, you have developed an accounting policy based on IAS 8, you have maybe something where you have in our standards have an option, which kind of option you choose. That is a kind of relevant information. But is it material? Material to for an investor to make an investment in this kind of entity? I don't buy that. We want to bring that together, but I don't think it fits.
Martin, just so I'm clear, is the concern really just a use of the word useful, that really maybe it's a drafting clarification that needs to be made instead of the not pervasive, but instead of having the word useful in here, just being crisper about consistently using material?
Yeah, we're bringing that into the old concept of materiality, and that is what I don't think is a good idea.
But can I build on Martin's point? Because, and this is a genuine question, I don't actually have terribly strong views on this, but don't laugh, Hans. But I think there's a couple of things going on. I think the word useful for me is too low level, because I think to Tack's point, you could have loads of useful information, but I think if we use that test, we probably have even more accounting policy disclosure than today, and I'm not sure that was what we set out to achieve. On the flip side, I think if somebody truly hand on heart picks is only required or guided to provide information on the accounting policies that are truly material, as in they truly could change an investment decision that somebody might make.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that might be fewer accounting policies than we might actually want disclosed. To Martin's point, there could be other stuff which I think could be really important for somebody to know, but whether it's material, I think, is another question. So I think the word useful is not the best word, and that's just a drafting thing, because I think that's
sort of useful.
That's not it's not aligned with what you're trying to do by putting it in the materiality practice statement. But I think the other question is it even going to be the right set of policies if they do apply it using the true notion of materiality?
There's one point I wanted to make here, actually, which is around the word useful, and I think there are two different ways in which we can use the word useful. There's
the materiality practice statement?
There's the useful as in just generally common everyday language useful, but then there's the useful in terms of making investment decisions, which is the objective of financial reporting. And I think what we need to be quite careful of is that we're clear about which one we're talking about in these. And I think we probably need to look at the examples here to make sure that we're using the right useful, or using useful. I would recommend that we only use useful if we're talking about it in the context that we talk about it in the conceptual framework, rather than talking about it in the more general sense. So if we're talking about it in the more general sense, we probably have to be careful about using useful.
But I think if we think we should put this in the materiality practice statement because we actually think we're applying the concept of materiality, I think it's really important to make sure that the word useful is tied back to the definition of materiality in the way it's used there.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that that's completely always going to line up with the more general use of the word useful in the conceptual framework, because it's a different thing. It's a different test. Mm. It's being used for a different purpose. I know that it's sort of, it's got roots that are similar, mm-hmm. but we're at some point with materiality, we're saying, is this information so important it could actually influence a decision? And I think that's a narrower set than useful information that's relevant. I think it's narrower, and you're frowning at me, but I really think that's important, and that's why we bang on all the time about think about your primary user, think about whether it could have influenced decisions. Mm. We never just say, is it useful? Otherwise, a materiality practice statement would say, provide that information if it's useful.
Yeah. And materiality, of course, is an entity-specific aspect of relevance, and so that's what we're trying to get to here.
But I think Martin's raising a slightly different point in addition to that, which is that really enough accounting policy applied purely as a materiality judgment?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's two different points here, and the use of useful, sorry, I can't think of another way to put that, is something that I feel like we can work on as we move this forward. So that one, I feel like that's something we can deal with. The second point that I think you're both making is the question of, do we actually want a direct link to materiality? Is that the right place to be? That was our recommendation in July, and that's, you know, the way we have been thinking about the guidance. And if I could just briefly explain why, you know, even with those questions, I think it's the right way to go, and then perhaps be interested to get your views, because it's good to know that we're moving in the right direction with our thinking. Our first question that we've already talked about means that we are effectively starting with items in the financial statements that are themselves material. So that's baseline. So then when we get to accounting policies, I look at it and go, well, in deciding, is the accounting policy itself material to users? If it's needed for users to understand what the material items in the financial statements are telling them, i.e. how they've been arrived at or how they've been measured or whatever element of the accounting policy it might be that needs to be explained so that users can understand that item, then that to me would be the trigger for the accounting policy being material. And that's the reason why I do feel like it is the correct test, because it's got to be the accounting policy is material if it is giving information that is necessary for users to understand the thing that is material properly. So that's our rationale for thinking that the materiality angle is the right route to go down, and it's perhaps articulation that we need to work on. But if you have more fundamental concerns about that link, then that discussion perhaps needs to come first.
Mary?
No, I'll pass, sorry.
I wanted to pursue what Catherine was suggesting, because I think it might be a mistake to talk about an accounting policy being material, because I don't see how an investor would ever change their decision based on what accounting policy you've got, I mean, unless it concludes that management's doing something odd, I suppose. But I think that the important thing is that it's part of a complete description. You're going to need to disclose it if it's necessary for a complete description of other information that is itself material. And so I'd maybe try and anchor it off that notion of completeness and perhaps understandability rather than off materiality directly. Because it's not material in its own right, it's just what part of what the description you need of other information that's material.
Okay. Are we ready to vote?
Not sure.
Well, let's try to give it a shot. Do we need to vote in pieces or?
I mean, the two questions that Siobhan teed up and that we're asking are essentially about. Do we develop guidance for the practice statement, sort of as we've worked in this paper, and do we develop examples? And I think perhaps if we take the questions as sticking literally to that, because I think if the board does vote yes, we're going to need another paper taking on board all of the comments about the content that we've heard today. But given the question we've had, those two literal questions, are we moving in the right direction in terms of guidance for the practice statement and examples? That would be a useful steer for us at the moment.
So, can I see who supports?
I don't mess up the vote, but just reflecting on what Peter said and what Martin said, I think there's maybe another way of thinking about the pieces of this is we want to say you must disclose material accounting policies. Okay, that's one of the things. And so we're trying first to develop guidance about how do you determine whether an accounting policy is material. And, you know, some of that is it's not automatically material just because the transaction or event to which it relates is material. There may be material disclosures. But once we say what's material, I think some of what has come up today is after you disclose what you must because it's material, you have to think about what in the conceptual framework we thought of as enhancing qualitative characteristics, which is completeness and things like completeness and understandability. So that may be in something that on itself is not material, but you know it's a consider type of thing. And so I think we should, I don't think it calls into question the vote we just took, because we want to be able to say you have to disclose what's material, and we're going to give you help figuring out what's material. But then think about what kind of extra comment we make about when you might provide additional information that itself is not an individually material piece of information, but is something that you might include for the understandability, which is an enhancing rather than fundamental characteristic of the financial statements as a whole. And that's a think about rather than you must.
Except it's not just understandability, it's completeness, which is part of faithful representation.
But I'm still confused because my understanding is materiality, because if we're calling that material accounting policies, bringing that into the materiality practice statement, I would conclude if, for example, in example 1B, as if I would a preparer and have not made this disclosure about the revenue recognition of online and offline, have missed that, it is a material error because we, in our example, we said it's a material accounting policy. I have to restate my financial statements because I have not made that accounting policies. I would never have made that conclusion before we have done that work here. Sorry to say that. And that is where I think, okay, if we're doing that, that the concept is not linking perfectly. I think it is what we try is a good thing, but as we should call it significant accounting policy. Or I don't know, to use another word, usefulness is too less, but not mixing that with the materiality concept. That is what I'm struggling really with. Because if we're doing that, people would make that conclusion. Auditors, regulators would make that conclusion. If you have that in the materiality practice statement, material policy calling that, if you have missed that or obscured that, or I don't know, then you have a material error of your financial statements, and the SEC will be after you.
Can I just clarify? Today, IAS 1 does require an entity to disclose its significant accounting policies.
Yeah.
So if an accounting policy was concluded by a regulator to be significant but was not disclosed, do you see that as different to the scenario that you're describing?
I would make a different judgment because I have always made judgment if I have a material error. I look, isn't potential investor have made a different decision based on the investment of this entity if I would have made this disclosure or error, yes or no? That was always my judgment.
It's got a very specific meaning.
And here is a different concept, I think. Here it is useful is maybe too less, but it is okay to useful to better understanding of that, to get an understanding, but it is not to this high level where I see materiality. And that is my problem. Maybe I'm not expressing that very well, but I think but the example is, as I said, is in 1B, if you have not have made that policy in your financial statements, I think the consequence is then you have a material error and you have to restate your financials. And in the past, I would have said, no, that is, if I would have said, okay, that is recognized one day or less before, would that really have an influence on investor? Maybe not. But if you take that example in the materiality practice statement, I think you cannot conclude otherwise.
Okay, I think perhaps the challenge we have is first working out how to move forward. Just to put this all in context, what was decided in July was that we would bring to the board our sort of thoughts and staff analysis on what we thought guidance in this area would look like, because in July the board did not feel that they had, that in the absence of an understanding of that guidance, the board felt that they could not make a decision about IAS 1 and the use of significant versus material. My feeling now, just to see if there are nods from the room, is that in light of this discussion, which has given us an awful lot to think about in terms of the content of any guidance that we might develop, I sense that there is support for the direction, albeit the language and the link to a word, whether it be material or significant, is still to be ironed out, and the feedback about the guidance we need to work on. So in terms of next steps, I think it might be helpful if we as staff bring a next paper which is about the significant material point, now that we have got an idea of the guidance we're thinking about on the table and discussed, and then having talked about significant material, after that we bring back another round of consideration of the content.
Councillor Azar.
I have my doubts, because, I mean, on what basis would we do that? How would you characterise what is significant?
Well, I think that's the discussion that needs to happen.
Want to have a significant practice statement? Yeah. I'm supportive of the progress you've made, and I agree that there are a number of cautions to be taken around the wording. But I wouldn't alter the direction, especially after you got the vote you got.
So, Catherine, what do we do?
Well, I think just to clarify on your point, Francoise, what I was suggesting wasn't to forget any of what we've discussed today. I think the general feeling we've got from the room is one of support for the direction, but details and feedback to work on in terms of improving it and making it better. I just think that in light of some of the concerns we've heard, the order of events might be best if we have a board discussion about significant versus material, and then another discussion about the, because we have to have both of those discussions, and it that would seem, in light of the feedback we've had, to
who?
Personally, I think that might be safer. And I think one thing I would be interested in is, if we think that the policies that are truly material in the traditional use of that word are a pretty big deal, and then there may be others that you'd want information to be provided about for sort of a completeness, et cetera, perspective, I think it would be good to know how we think, if we're going to say something on those as well, and if so, how does that fit with what's in the materiality practice statement? Because I agree that I feel like there's a sort of two tiers there, although having said that, I'm a little bit worried we might be getting back to the tiering system that we were told in the COD discussion paper was not a great idea, which is also in the back of my mind. So I think we need to tread carefully, but I think we've raised so many different things at the table that it might be safer to reflect.
Okay, so that absolves us of further votes.
The board might not agree, Francois.
Can I get just one? I want to come back to what Mary said. I if you just bring back significant material, I'm not sure that'll do it. Okay. I think the more critical thing is more what Mary said, is the problem with transporting materiality to policies is policies are important, I'll use a totally different word, are important because they drive the numbers, and the numbers, we develop materiality about the numbers and the statements. And so if I have two entities and they're doing different revenue recognition, those numbers mean really different things. And it's this knock-on effect, applying kind of like what Peter said, is you can't just look at the policy in isolation, because it's this knock-on effect. And I'm not sure if Mary can correct me, but if that's what she was trying to get at, with completeness and things. So when you that'd be my one concern, is if you bring back materiality and significance alone, it's this fact that material
materiality of a policy has to go through the numbers. And it's a more complex thing because are you doing industry practice? Are you doing, you know, like the reference points are more diverse and greater. So I'm not sure what the answer is. I think we're on the right path, but I'd hate to just focus in on is significant the word or material the word. I think it's the underlying meaning and how to interpret in the context of policies. And if you could kind of fill it out, which again is what I thought what Mary said, is fill out in the context of a policy. But I don't know, Mary, do you want to add? No. I'm not misquoting. Okay, so anyway.
Okay, well, I suggest that you want these issues and come back to us at a later date. Uh-huh. All right, thank you very much. We'll now take a break until the originally planned starting point of our discussion on insurance contracts, so until 3:15.